And then we're going to wander along the river. So we're going to wander along the bank side. We're going to go to the site of the Winchester Palace and the Clink, which is here. We're going to go over to the site of the original Globe Theatre, which was over here. And then we're going to visit the Globe itself, the reconstructed Globe. So we're going to sort of do a virtual sort of walk along the river. Before we do that, I just wanted to just come back to talking about some play practices. What costumes did the actors wear? Well, here we can see, of course, a male actor playing a female role, which, of course, we know that that happened. The really interesting thing, of course, is that in Shakespeare's lifetime, clothes reflect, you know, a person's status in society. And there were very strict laws controlling what you could wear. They were called sumptuary laws. But because actors or players at the playhouses had all kinds of characters in them, kings, queens, wealthy people, the costumes reflected the character's social status. So although mostly actors would have not been allowed to wear the most beautiful fabrics like velvets and silks and brocades, they were allowed to because they were playing those parts. In fact, they wore contemporary clothes. So they wore basically the latest fashions on stage. So people went to see the plays as much for the content and the story as they did for the latest fashions on stage. And really, the costumes were the most expensive part of the budget. And a company like the Lord Chamberlain's Men probably spend about £300 a year on costumes, which would be probably about £35,000 today. So interesting. They did recycle a lot of the costumes, particularly for the lesser characters. And actually, some actors left each other clothes in their wills. There are some accounts that servants who were left clothes by their masters in their wills and wouldn't be allowed to wear those fabrics because of these strict fashion laws would sell the costumes on to the acting companies. So it's quite interesting, all of that. And one other quick thing here is that, of course, this business of male players in female roles. And Shakespeare writes incredible roles for women. I mean, Cleopatra, Lady Macbeth, Ophelia, Juliet, but of course never sees a woman actually playing the roles. And they must have been really wonderful actors, these young boy actors that played the roles. The reason that they didn't use female actors was partly because it was sort of a Protestant, sort of Northern European Puritan thing. You know, it's unseemly for women to be playing on stage. But also they didn't think women were capable. They didn't think they were as good. If you'd gone to Spain or to France or to Italy, to Mediterranean, there were women actors there, no problem at all in the Catholic countries. So it was a very peculiarly sort of Northern European thing. And of course, Shakespeare uses this gender confusion to maximum effect. So if you think of Rosalind in As You Like It or Viola in Twelfth Night, they disguise themselves as boys. So you've got boys playing girls playing boys. So we think of gender fluidity being a modern thing, don't we? But definitely not. This is quite interesting. This is a cap that was found in Moorfields in north of the city in the 19th century. And this would have been an apprentice's cap. And it dates to the 16th century. It was probably worn by a young man. And it's really important because in 1571, a parliamentary statute stipulated every male over the age of 6 years old had to wear one of these on Sundays and on holidays. And the reason the law was introduced was because it was to try and support the English wool industry at the time. In fact, I mean, apprentices, you know, learning a trade in the city of craft would have worn these. But of course, obviously, noblemen and gentlemen wore headgear as well, but they would have worn more fancy hats. In fact, if you went without a hat at the time, you were considered to be, you know, something wrong with you. But Hamlet, Ophelia says about Hamlet that he appears hatless, and it's clearly a sign of madness. But had Shakespeare been peeking through, you know, the doors of the Tiring House onto the Globe stage, or had the actors been looking out from the stage towards the audience, they'd have probably seen a sea of flat caps like that, because many of the members of the audience standing would have been young apprentices, probably skiving off, actually, for the day to go and see or hear a play. OK, we're going to take a little stroll now. Now, you might recognise where we are there. That is the south side of London Bridge, and that is a view of Borough Market on the left. That's our world-famous food market. We're going to take a little stroll a little bit further south along Borough High Street, because in Shakespeare's lifetime, this was lined with coaching inns. And you can see the little entrance there. And a little bit further down, we're going to carry on down, the whole of the street was lined with inns. Now, I call them coaching inns. And there's the entrance there. You can see how narrow the alleyway is. If you went back to the Middle Ages, on that particular spot, you would have found the Tabard Inn. And the Tabard Inn was where Geoffrey Chaucer set the Canterbury Tales. And of course, Chaucer considered to be the father of sort of modern English literature. And what they were, these inns, were places where people stayed overnight before they went on a very long journey. Quite often, they were pilgrims because they were going down, continuing down that busy road down to Canterbury, which was a three or four day journey. And the reason I mention this is because all those inns were swept away by the time the railways arrived, really, in the 1830s, 1840s. But one of them still survives, and it's called the George Inn. And some of you might know it, and if you don't, put it on your list to go and visit. And it's just across from where Borough Market is. And that's a view of the George Inn today. It was actually built in 1676, this one, but there had been an inn on the site since, we believe, at least the 1400s. And what you can see on the right is you can see the ground floor where you enter the inn, or the pub as it is today. You can see the first floor balcony, and you can see the second floor balcony. Now, there's only one side of that today. That's the only side that's left of what would have been a three-sided building. If we go to this image, this is a sketch of what the inside of an inn would have been like with all three sides. And you can see there's a raised stage there. And you can see that the audience are standing around the raised stage with the three sides around them. So what happened was that before that theatre was built in Shoreditch, this is how people saw plays, in these inn yards. That's what they were called, inn yards. So the actors were mobile. They would bring the stage, probably on the back of the cart, with the costumes, maybe a few props, and they would perform in the middle of the yard. And it was James Burbage that thought to himself, right, 1576, I'm going to improve on this. I'm going to now not just have an open side, I'm going to make sure the whole building is closed in, and I'm going to make sure that people definitely pay to come in by having those ladies standing outside collecting the money. So that's how we evolved from those inn yards to our purpose-built theatre buildings. Now, if we just imagine we've walked through a lovely Borough Market with all its lovely smells, we now come to Southwark Cathedral. Now, Southwark Cathedral, which you see there today, was only a cathedral, made a cathedral in 1905, but it would have been known in Shakespeare's lifetime as the parish church of St. Mary Overy. So it was the main church of the south of Bankside, the south side of the river, Southwark. And there are some quite important connections. And we believe Shakespeare worshipped at the church, but we do know that he paid for a funeral. And he paid for the funeral of this young man. And this is Edmund Shakespeare, and that's his gravestone that is in Southwark Cathedral today. Now, Edmund was one of the seven other brothers and sisters of Shakespeare. And it seems that he came to London with William and joined him as an actor at that early theatre, and then possibly joined him at the Globe. Oh, somebody's unmuted themselves. I can hear some background noise. Somebody could just mute themselves. Thank you. And sadly, he died, and we think he probably died of plague. We don't know for sure, but 1607, he was only in his mid-20s, and Shakespeare paid for the funeral services, and we know that he paid for the bells to be rung at the church. So that's a little homage to Shakespeare's not so well known younger brother. We also find in the cathedral today this beautiful memorial window, which is dedicated to Shakespeare. And it's absolutely wonderful because it has lots of characters from the plays, including you can see Falstaff there from Henry the Fourth's Part 1 and 2, and also the Merry Wives of Windsor. Difficult to see perhaps here, but we have got some characters from Midsummer Night's Dream. I think I can see Bottom there with his ass's head on the left. And in the middle, we've got Prospero, the magician from The Tempest, which was one of Shakespeare's, we believe, his sort of last plays. And underneath that window is this monument, or memorial statue, really. And this was done in 1912. It's made out of alabaster. And what's rather nice is you can see Shakespeare in his doublet and hose. And he's holding, what's he holding there? A sprig of rosemary. And do you remember yesterday, people were laying sprigs of rosemary on Shakespeare's grave. There's rosemary, that's for remembrance, which is a line that Ophelia utters in Hamlet. And this is a very recent statue that's only just been gifted to the cathedral, and it sits in the churchyard, and it's it was actually cast in bronze by a British sculptor called Raphael Maclouf, who was assisted by a lady called Hayley Gibbs, and it represents Shakespeare in his early 30s sitting on a bench. And of course that's the time when he's sort of really at the height of his powers, living in Southwark. It was actually made in Shoreditch, and it was cast at the Bronze Age Foundry in Limehouse, I think. Now, originally, it was destined to go on the site of where they've been doing all those excavations in Shoreditch. And they plan to open a whole visitor exhibition centre on the site of the theatre back last summer, but that's all on hold at the moment. So I understand that the statue has been sort of loaned to Southwark Cathedral until such time as we can go and visit this new Shakespeare site in Shoreditch. So let's hope that happens quite soon. Now, if we go around the corner from the cathedral, we would get this wonderful view of a ship. And this is a replica of the Golden Hind, which was the ship in which Sir Francis Drake circumnavigated the globe in 1577 and came back nearly 3 years later. Now, little William would have been 11 years old when that ship set sail. And there is a theory that somehow he stowed away, but I can't quite work that out, really, because he would have been too young. So I don't know how that theory came about. Anyway, it was a hugely important journey, of course, because although the Portuguese had gone round the globe 40 years before, it was the first English circumnavigation of the globe, and Drake plundered lots of Spanish ships, of course, and brought the Spanish silver back to England, and he doubled Queen Elizabeth's income, so no wonder she knighted him. He was made Sir Francis Drake. But what's really important about the journey is that it changed people's perception of the world, and people thought differently about the world, and as a result of the journey, globes now start to be produced, which were quite expensive items, in addition to, you know, sort of regular sort of flat maps. In 1592, when Shakespeare writes The Comedy of Errors, there's a lovely, rather comic scene where a servant called Dromio refers to a rather buxom kitchen maid as the globe. So he uses her as an analogy, and he goes off on a geography lesson all around her body seeking treasure. And he says that a maid is like Spanish silver. So you see there's a direct reference there to Drake's voyage. In fact, this is the dialogue. "She is spherical like a globe. I could find out countries in her." His friend says, "In what part of her body stands Ireland? Marry in her buttocks. I found it out by the bogs. Where Scotland? I found it out by the barrenness hard in the palm of her hand." I mean, these are really sexist jokes. So, you know, it is of its time. "Where America, the Indies? Oh, sir, upon her now all are embellished with rubies, carbuncles, sapphires, declining their rich aspect to the hot breath of Spain, who sent whole armadas of carracks to ballast at her nose. Where stood Belgia, the Netherlands? Oh, sir, I did not look so low." So there's kind of, you know, pretty obvious puns going on there. But it's all about, you know, a global journey, isn't it? And I can't help thinking that when Shakespeare and his company of actors, the Lord Chamberlain's men, are searching for a new name for their newly built theatre, the Globe was a great decision, a great choice, because it was a new concept to the theatre-going public. And you even get references, for example, in Midsummer Night's Dream, where Oberon says to Puck, we the Globe can compass soon, swifter than the wandering moon. And Puck says, I'll put a girdle around the earth in 40 minutes. And that would have been a pretty radical new idea to the audience listening to those words at the time.